I'm slowly catching up to the fact that if I have these questions that I put up for you to study over the weekend, that it's just like a little itty miniature exam. Which means that when you all, this section, are sitting in the cafeteria there on Monday and Wednesday, when the poor section one and two comes through, what's the answer to that question he's going to ask? Right? Or have you all figured that out yet? Oh, you're looking at me like, oh, we don't know what you're talking about, Dr. Gray. But I never had decided ahead of time who I was going to ask about that. Correct? So let's just get these out of the way. That I was going to ask what?
No,
Yasmin? Is that who I'm going to ask first? But she always participates in lecture. Or do you happen to know that she just managed not to study this particular question? And I would ask you, except you'd already, your only reason you're trying to get her in trouble is you probably already know the answer, correct? Do you already know the answer to this, what I'm about to ask? Oh, so you've forgotten it. Dante, what would happen?
No, I'm not answering. I want to let the class participate.
But I haven't called on anybody to answer questions yet this quarter for this section, correct? Or did I? Oh, I asked him last time. Oh, that's right. You used yours up already. Oh, too bad. Sana, what would happen if we did have an excess of isotopically labeled water and acid and heat? Could the carbonyl oxygen also get replaced with oxygen 18 if there was a massive excess of the water?
Yes,
it will. And here is the point of this. And actually, your textbook takes it from the opposite perspective. It starts with an oxygen 18 at the carbonyl position. And then it has a reaction that involves water or hydroxide. I forget now the details. But here's the point. If there was never that tetrahedral intermediate that I pointed out the other day, you know, at some point, if we imagine water attacking the carbonyl, and this is an acid mechanism, so yes, the carbonyl will get protonated first. But still, the carbonyl gets attacked and pushed open. If the carbonyl never got involved in that process, then if you had an O18 on the carbonyl, it would never get substituted. So in other words, the book, let me just go ahead and write it out then, the outline of what it discusses. It says that, let's say you had a carboxylic acid that's reacted with water somehow. It asks the other form of the question is, can you get rid of the O18 just by prolonged exposure to water? If water were to attack and kick off hydroxide, which that's why this is not exactly the example, because that doesn't make sense that you can kick hydroxide off as a leaving group. But suppose in whatever carboxylic acid derivative that's reacted, if you somehow attacked and pushed off the leaving group without the carbonyl ever being involved, there would be no way to remove O18 from that starting molecule. The point of the experiment is that if you got rid of it, that means you went through that tetrahedral intermediate. That means when we're writing a reaction mechanism like saponification, there's two ways, in theory, we could write it. One is if we did this. We ignore the opening of the carbonyl and show it kind of like you're doing SN2. This is just the first step. Of course, afterwards, we have that neutralization that instantly occurs. But in principle, then, if I put O18 here for the carbonyl oxygen, if this were the mechanism, you would always end up with the O18 up top in the product as well. Because by this mechanism, the carbonyl never is involved. It really is like an SN2 reaction. Let me write out the connection between these two thoughts. Because over here, the answer is yes, the O18 will disappear. And the fact that oxygen 18 can be added to or removed from the carbonyl position means the reaction goes through a tetrahedral intermediate. This means that saponification, for example, cannot be written as if it was an SN2 reaction. Yes. O18 can be detected separately from regular oxygen 16, so there's a way to trace that this really is happening. There's also a way to trace the, what kind of sugary drink is that right there? I believe it's radioactive, and I don't remember if it's radioactivity or NMR they use to detect it, but there is some way to get it. There's no coffee cup in here today, is there? Looking around. Okay. Just keeping track, you know. Now, there was another question, though, I asked, wasn't there, Davis? Where if I had... Hey, you all are just lucky that you're not getting the treatment that 10 years ago they got, because I must have had a lot more energy then, or I must have cared a lot less about certain topics, because it was like every other day in lecture where I had people working synthesis problems up at the board. Of course, we didn't get through as much mechanism then. That's why I'm saying, you know, not that this might not be a better balance, but it could get worse. Davis, if I have... What is the name of that molecule, by the way? This one right here. It's an ester. That's the functional group. What kind of alkyl group is attached to the oxygen there? Ethyl, all right? And if I put an O minus instead of that ethyl group, what would we call this ion that's there? Think vinegar. Acetate. This is ethyl acetate. So if ethyl acetate reacts with an excess of propanol, propane 1-ol, acid and heat, what's going to happen? Say it again. So this gets replaced by that. Is that what you're saying? Yes, that is what happens. And this is a process known as transesterification. Transesterification doesn't mean cis-trans. It means like transferred, a change. So you're taking one ester and creating another. Think about what the reaction mechanism is. It's a whole bunch of protonate, open-attacky, protonate, protonate, open-attacky, protonate. Well, after the first round of protonate, open-attacky, protonate, you would have both of these alcohols, the one you start with, the ethanol, and the propanol, potentially connected together. You notice that some of these things I'm describing unlike some of my normal habit would be, I'm not writing all these things down, because I'm really, truly hoping that you all have already started studying your mechanisms and can visualize that when I say, imagine one round of protonate open attack deprotonate, you are able to conceptualize that. Now, let me just double check here. How many of you have made a flashcard or done something to study the Fischer esterification, our prototypical example of a cationic reaction? And how many of you made a flashcard of other, some kind of study device for saponification, focusing both on the mechanism and the portions of which are irreversible and reversible? And how many of you could recite either mine or the textbooks, which they're different, the order of reactivities of the different carboxylic acid derivatives, and how many of you can name the seven that we've covered? Now, isn't that last bit of information, the different derivatives and their order of reactivity, something I already hinted is going to be on the first quiz? So I know I already gave you the you need to study lecture this morning, but we hadn't done anything else this quarter except those things I just mentioned. So even if you didn't have a syllabus or anything else, you got your textbooks, you got your brains, and you know it's coming. So don't depend on me so much. I know I'm your instructor, but you're the only one that makes you pass. And beyond everything else, it's what you do, not what I do. So if you don't know what Fischer esterification mechanism is, that's a big, huge problem. Someone described to me how I would write out the intermediate after one cycle of protonate open attack deprotonate. What would I have at that point in this case? Direct me how to draw that. No, don't tell me how each step of the mechanism works. Give me a name or give me a way to draw the structure of the intermediate that forms after one round of protonate open attack deprotonate. Okay, two carbon compound with an alcohol. Okay. Ether. Propyl. So you have three different oxygens, all three of which, if they were to dissociate, which that's not how the mechanism works, but if they all came off all of a sudden, they'd be all about the same strength as each other in terms of bases. That means once you do go through protonate and open, that all three of these are just as likely as each other to come off the molecule. If the OH came off, you get something you can't isolate. If the propoxide came off, you go back to the starting material. But since you're flooding this with the propanol, you're going to end up with that product. This is the acid version of it, but the base version is just as important. And I gave an example like this yesterday. I think it was partly the way I presented it that what my main intention of the example was got lost at first. So let me warn you that this example is not to show you something about synthesis, not about substitution or elimination. The example is to show you what else you must consider in terms of compatibility of reagents with the molecule you're trying to do a reaction on. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Here's the example. Now, let's say we had an excess of sodium hydroxide. Let's say that I want an elimination reaction to occur. Which, why would it make sense elimination reaction could be happening? We have secondary alkyl halide, and we have a base, which secondaries with basic nucleophiles tend to eliminate, especially when we've got heat like this. But that's not going to be the product of this reaction. If we wanted to do elimination, fine, but we needed to choose a different base because hydroxide with heat and time is not just going to cause the elimination, it's also going to cause saponification. Even if we did use an alcohol, here, I'll keep the same example material. Then, yeah, because it's a strong base, using an alkoxide, we're going to get elimination. But because it's not the same as what was already part of the ester, we're going to change the ester also. So whenever you use bases, if esters are present, care must be taken that you choose the correct base based on the structure of the ester. The above example demonstrates that the base used to perform a reaction with an ester present must be chosen carefully. So as to avoid saponification or transesterification of that ester. Questions? Well, we've wrapped. Oh, yes.
If you have a longer chain of the alcohol, is the alcohol itself more acidic? Less. Usually, the more alkyl groups in solution you have, the less acidic it is. So, methanol and ethanol are about pKa 16. But terbutanol is about 18. Other questions?
Then this wraps up the first chunk of material, you could say, because we've had our introduction to the different carboxylic acid derivatives. This is all chapter 17 material, effectively. How many of you recognize that we're in chapter 17 at the moment? Okay. And if you do read through the chapter, it has exactly what I had told you, that it has an overview of the reactivity of carbonyls combining aldehydes, ketones, and the carboxylic acid derivatives all together, but also gives you an overview, therefore, of carboxylic acid chemistry. And so we covered the carboxylic acid derivatives, a very typical example of a cationic mechanism, a very typical example of an anionic mechanism. We talked about how there might be both sometimes, and a cationic and anionic way to do a reaction. And in fact, I forgot to show you something related to that, or I did show it to you but didn't put it together this way. When we did the Fischer esterification and I said there's deesterification, that's also called hydrolysis. Which essentially just means reaction with water. But you can take an ester and do an acid-catalyzed reaction with water and get a carboxylic acid. We could also, and that would be called hydrolysis. We could do saponification, which is the base version. So there is both an acid and base version of going from an ester to a carboxylic acid. There's not both a way to go in an acid version and a base version from a carboxylic acid back to an ester. That's what we discussed last lecture. And that's because of carboxylic acids themselves being unusual in that they're acidic. So it doesn't have just to do with the fact they have a carbonyl. It's the fact that they're an acidic functional group. Where we need to go next is to approach the other remaining carboxylic acid derivatives, because all we've played with so far are acids and esters. But now what about acyl halides, anhydrides, nitriles, amides? Well, that's where we're going next. And we're going to be studying a set of reactions with those functional groups, one of which is hydrolysis, another one of which is similar, but it's called solvolysis. And it's usually used as a shorthand way of saying a reaction with an alcohol. So transesterification could also be called solvolysis. You're reacting with a different alcohol. Then there's aminolysis, which means a reaction with an amine, which we'll see is one of the ways we can produce an amide. So, we're going to discuss acyl halides, we'll briefly discuss anhydrides, and we'll get started with amides today, but won't get very far. So, acyl halides. Now, I made reference to the functional group reactivity patterns. So remember that acyl halides are the most reactive of the carboxylic acid derivatives. One, because they have a chloride, which is a good leaving group, and two, because the carbonyl has got a larger than average delta positive on it. Both of those reasons together make the acyl halide more likely to react. What reactions can an acyl halide do? The three right here, hydrolysis, solvolysis, aminolysis, along with two other reactions, and this is now getting into chapter 18 material. The two other reactions that we will more carefully discuss end of this week, early next week after the quiz, are reduction and Grignard reactions, alkylation. So each functional group has its own little special gotcha that occurs when we're doing mechanisms with lithium aluminum hydride or with a Grignard reagent. For these reactions, hydrolysis, solvolysis, aminolysis, the mechanisms are all very, very similar. So we're starting with these because they're the simple ones. I'm giving you the warning, which do with it as you will, but I'm telling you that the ones that are going to be painful in comparison are the Grignard and the reduction mechanisms. If you were smart, not smart, dedicated. No, because there's intelligence and that's a very different thing. If you're organized enough, dedicated enough, concerned enough, you'll start reading about the Grignard and the reduction. Knowing a trick question I will ask on the first exam or the second one, let me show you two more functional groups that we've already seen, but not in this form. We take an ester and we twist it around in a circle. Does anybody happen to know what this kind of creature is called? Someone totally floored me yesterday and got it right. They said, well, it's in the book. I said, it couldn't have been a more beautiful answer. It's in the book. Yeah.
Lactone?
Lactone, that is right. Which makes it sound like it has something to do with milk, but I don't remember if that's true or how that connection is there. So if I can find out a reason, I'll let you know. I'm presuming it's on the basis of this that we get the name for its nitrogen equivalent, which, do you happen to know that one? Lactam. Besides just the fact you need to know what these functional groups are, there is a difference for one of these two groups between its reactivity and its non-cyclic counterpart. And that's why, again, the hint that you need to start working on the reduction or the Grignard mechanisms with esters and amines. Or contrast that with lactones and lactams. So we are going to look at the other functional groups. We're going to do the simple set of reactions. We're going to then come back to the Grignard reduction. Let's start with acyl halides. So acyl halides are reactive enough that you don't need a strong base to force the carbonyl open. You don't need an acid catalyst to cajole the carbonyl into reacting. So if we use neutral, acidic, or basic reagents, all of them will work. Now if you use a basic reagent like sodium hydroxide, that's going to be a massively favorable reaction because you're using a strong nucleophile with this thing that's got a good leaving group. So very rapid, I can't imagine it wouldn't be extremely exothermic reaction. Again, I won't write down a reaction mechanism for every small example we do. So I will point out, though, that this is going to occur by an anionic mechanism, which actually, if you're really, really, really perceptive, you'll say, hey, hydroxide's a reagent. You're making an acid as a product. Before the carbonyl can get attacked by more hydroxide, doesn't that mean the acid could get deprotonated? Which, yes, that means we really should follow it up with an acid workup step. Now, if we use neutral water, the acyl halide is still reactive enough to react with water, which last quarter, if you use this particular acyl halide, acetyl chloride, and you open the bottle up and you just sat there with it, you would have known that water was reactive enough because you would have gotten that cloud of hydrochloric acid vapor coming your way. It forms the same product. It is still effectively the anionic mechanism because water is not acidic enough to cause the protonation to start the process. But you also don't end up with hydroxide in solution, or do you? No, you end up with HCl in solution, so there's no need for follow-up H+. Now, in theory, you could use water in acidic conditions to get the same product. But if water's reactive enough, why throw another chemical at this? Especially if your acid catalyst is wet, which right now we're showing just reaction of water. This is hydrolysis. But if we wanted to react with an alcohol, but we use an acid catalyst that was wet, then that means we're going to end up with multiple products. I'll just make it simple, though, and say usually unnecessary to use acid catalysts. Now, as I said just a moment ago, this is all hydrolysis. What about solvolysis? Happens too. And let me show you an example of a short synthesis that demonstrates why acyl halides can be useful. Actually, let's start not even with an acyl halide. Let's start with this unsaturated carboxylic acid. Let's say we want to make an ethyl ester out of it. That's fine. These are the conditions to make the ethyl ester. They're also the conditions to add to the double bond. So if you have excess alcohol sitting around, you're not just going to get an ester. You'll get an ether as well. So in this case, esterification will occur. But a side reaction will occur as well. Since the reaction conditions are incompatible. Incompatible with alkenes. So what can we do? Well, make an acyl halide. Now, we have not seen this mechanism yet, right? In this section, we have not done with an acid the thionyl chloride mechanism. But it's nearly identical to the mechanism that you would have if you did it with an alcohol. But since we have not done the mechanism, let's go ahead and do it. As a reminder, the most missed aspect when writing this mechanism is the fact that the sulfur has a lone pair on it. So sulfur, really delta positive, because it's got these chlorines and oxygens around it, very likely to be attacked by even the alcohol portion of a carboxylic acid. And after we pushed open that sulfur-oxygen double bond, it will reform. And when it does so, one of the two chlorines gets kicked off. Deprotonation of the oxonium can then occur. The last step, even though chloride's not all that basic, this functional group starting from the oxygen with the sulfur and the oxygen and chlorine that are all attached, that whole thing is a really good leaving group. So normally it wouldn't be favorable for a carbonyl to be attacked by chloride, but in this case, if it does, then when the carbonyl reforms, instead of chloride being kicked out, it's this whole sulfur group that gets kicked out instead. Oops. Forgot my sulfur lone pairs, didn't I? So carbonyl reforms, it kicks off the leaving group, which decomposes because of it. That's part of the driving force for why this is a good leaving group, because we form sulfur dioxide as a byproduct. And then we have our acyl halide. Notice that even though H plus comes off here, so we have acidic conditions, often we can use a base scavenger like pyridine or something to help mop up some of that extra acid that's around. So we could do this while still preserving the alkene. We could then take that first step of creating a leaving group from a carboxylic acid. Convert the carboxylic acid, in other words, to the acyl halide. React that with a neutral alcohol. It will have an anionic style mechanism. But it also lets us form the ester, again, without that alkene being affected. Now, this is just one way to make an amide, though. We're going to see another reagent, DCC. If you happen to encounter it in your reading, ignore it just for the moment, because we'll tackle it closer to the time we deal with amino acids. Because amino acids are made of amide linkages, and so we want to investigate ways to make amides. Yes? Is it A-B-L-E? Incompatible. No, if you look at it's actually referring to what came up above. Esterification will occur, but a side reaction occurs as well. So notice that in the top version, I've added something at the double bond position also. In this bottom version, this is the one that avoids that. So this is where, if you wanted to only do esterification, you could do this instead. Then there's one other way also to do it with that reagent DCC. But ignore DCC just for the moment. Question? Does it have the tetrahedral intermediate? I have not looked up yet in my advanced text to see whether it is one step or two, if it also has the same tetrahedral properties as carboxylic acid. Of course, it won't technically be tetrahedral. It'll be seesaw, five-pair electron geometry, but only four real bonds. I think that's seesaw shape. So it'll technically be a seesaw derivative. Or intermediate. Now, what else did I have with acyl halides? Let me take a look here. Oh, well, yes, there is one other thing we could use acyl halides for. We've shown how to make, we can go revert back to carboxylic acids just by reacting with water. We can make esters if we use an alcohol. We can make amides if we use an amine. So again, another very mini synthesis. We make the leaving group. Now react it with an amine. It's also an anionic style mechanism, where, especially in this case, because the amine is a base. So the base attacks the carbonyl without the need for pre-protonation. Once the carbonyl is open, it collapses again, kicking out the alcohol. One last reaction, which leads us into our next functional group. If we take an acyl halide, we could react it with a carboxylic acid salt. That salt's a base. This is a weak base, though. because it's stabilized by the carbonyl. But it could still attack an acyl halide. And look what you would make as a result. If the R groups were the same, you make a what's called a symmetric anhydride, or you have the potential, if the R groups are different, to make an asymmetric anhydride. Now, other than Grignard reactions and reductions, we're done talking about acyl halides for now. So are there any questions about acyl halides? Then let's move into talking about anhydrides. We're not actually going to do much with anhydrides. And if you're keeping track here, that's going to lower your stress level a little bit. Because in theory, now I did this thing where I tried to scare you at first, where I said, imagine we have all these different carboxylic acid derivatives. Multiply that by all these different reactions we're going to learn. Multiply that by the potential for there to be both a cationic and anionic mechanism for something. And so I tried to scare you with this idea that we might have 6 × 5 × 2 reactions or 60 or so different reactions you need to learn. But as you can see, there's so many of these reactions that are just variations of each other. If you go back and look at aminolysis, solvolysis, hydrolysis, all the same mechanism. Anhydrides, if we're not covering them much, then that eliminates a whole bunch of reactions you need to worry about. But for anhydrides, you should understand why is it that they're not usually as useful. And it's exactly because of this asymmetric anhydride. An anhydride reacts much like an acyl halide will, meaning if we had a symmetric anhydride, when it reacts with water, we get two of the same product. The same carboxylic acid back again. But if we took a mixed anhydride, an asymmetric anhydride, then you get two products. By extension, if you wanted to try to make one specific ester, then if you use a mixed anhydride, half your product is garbage. If you use a mixed anhydride, only one half or the other is useful. So usually only symmetric anhydrides are useful synthetically. Now, another reason why anhydrides aren't as commonly used is if an acyl halide is a more reactive group and it's an easier group to form. I'll show you a way we could synthesize anhydrides in a moment, but it's generally easier to get to the acyl halide. So if you have that option, why would you use an anhydride? But it's not that anhydrides are never used, and there's some applications where they may be the only choice. Maybe they're less reactive enough that they prevent some other bizarre sort of side reaction. Let me do show you two tricks with anhydrides that you should know. One is how to form them. And that's often done using a dehydrating agent. Specifically, diphosphorus pentoxide. So that diphosphorus pentoxide will absorb water because it's trying to form phosphoric acid. But it ends up being incredibly hygroscopic, enough so that with time and maybe some heat, it will cause the removal of water from two carboxylic acids to make the anhydride. There is also this trick that can be done, though. And I won't write the details of this out because it is a bit more advanced, but it's not difficult to describe. To form an anhydride from a larger carboxylic acid, you'll often react that carboxylic acid with an anhydride. Initially, you might end up with a crossed or a mixed anhydride. But over time and with some heat, you're going to end up with this larger anhydride. Why? Because acetic acid can be distilled at a relatively low temperature. But make a larger anhydride much more difficult to distill. The boiling points go shooting way up. So with a mixture of all this put together, it's going to be the acetic acid that bubbles out first. So you keep removing acetic acid, which keeps driving the reaction further to the right. So it's not solubility per se, but it is an equilibrium trick that is done. Now otherwise, let me just show you that an anhydride could react under, I showed you hydrolysis. It's the same as solvolysis, so let me show you aminolysis. Just as a brief example. And that's about all we're going to do with anhydrides. Now, with the tiny bit of time remaining, what time is it? Yes, let me just squeeze this in. So just a reminder, you want to be looking at acyl halides. You drinking the lab water now? You're that desperate that you need the lab water? Good grief. I mean, it's deionized, but you don't know how fresh this deionized system is. My goodness. And you don't even have your lab goggles on handling lab equipment. My goodness, double strike against you. Good thing we're not using names on these recordings, are we? So you have your warning, look at the reduction, look at the alkylation, which means the Grignard reaction, but amides, where we're going to start with on Thursday, is the reactivity of an amide. And we'll start with a simple reaction like even saponification, which let me really quickly blaze through that mechanism. The hydrogen on the nitrogen we're going to discover is not acidic. So it's really going to be the carbonyl that tends to get attacked here. And so this is actually exactly the same as saponification as you've seen before. The only difference is it usually has to be a much more vigorous reaction. Because yes, at this point the carbonyl is going to try to reform. But look at the two choices of what's going to get kicked out. Hydroxide, O minus, or N minus. Now, which one is the stronger base in general? Something that's O minus or something that's N minus? N, because N is less electronegative, so it is less favorable to try to tolerate a negative charge. So nitrogen positive, in fact, is not unusual. Nitrogen negative is extraordinarily basic, generally. So there's a mismatch in base strengths. But one idea we're going to develop next time, and maybe I said this during lab lecture, is that if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. If there's a small chance that at some point this nitrogen minus will get kicked out, even though it's unfavorable, when it does happen, the reaction becomes irreversible for the exact same reasons we've studied before, that we've just made a base, a really strong one, and an acid. So you get instant neutralization. Which means acid, after acid workup, we can get the carboxylic acid back again. Are there any quick questions before we end for today? Then no pre-lab on Thursday, because we'll be doing IR, we'll be continuing with the current experiment, and then we'll continue with amides as far as lecture.